Hi, it's Rachel Martin with NPR News. And you know what? We're doing something new. And we want you to be part of it. It's called Up First. It's the morning news podcast from NPR. It's a way for you in about 10 minutes or so to get up to speed on the news of any given day. The most important stories, the biggest ideas, the stuff you need to know as you go through your day. Up First, it starts April 5th. You can get it at NPR One or anywhere you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll look at the new podcast, S-Town, and we'll visit the offbeat protagonist of the British comedy, Chewing Gum, which is about to return for a second season.
My mum was going to name me Alyssa, which means sweet angel in Indian, but when I came out, she looked at me and she called me Tracy.
And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in semi-historic Studio 46, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair from WBUR in Boston is our library consultant and half of the Two Bossy Dames newsletter, Margaret H. Willison. Hey, Margaret.
Hi, guys. Happy to be your British sitcom you can't necessarily talk about on NPR. Correspondent.
That's right. That's right. Well, before we get started, I do want to note, by the way, that tickets are still available for our Chicago live show on April 12th with Sam Sanders in the fourth chair and W. Kamau Bell as our guest. You can still grab those at nprpresents.org. And we do have one other thing to tell you about that show. Stephen, you want to tell us who's going to be the musical guest
yes.
at the Chicago show?
Yeah, we managed to book a band from Chicago called Mukapaza, who is a record holder at the NPR Tiny Desk for largest band we have ever managed to fit in that space. When they played the Tiny Desk, there were 23 of them, including dancers and horns.
There were like people yelling,
people
and very high in number of people, but also from what I have seen of it, very high in joy.
Yes, it really was. We actually stacked people up like on top of the bookshelves that line the Tiny Desk. We were almost literally stacking them like cordwood.
It's going to be quite a show.
They're delightful.
There's going to be chair dancing. We are very excited about that. So you will also get to see our wonderful musical guest in Chicago, and Sam, and W. Kamau Bell, and us nerds. So again, NPR presents. Presents.org. Now, to shift gears rather emphatically, you've probably heard that narrative podcasting is having a moment. The first podcast to get that kind of press was the first season of Serial, an offshoot of This American Life. But now the team behind Serial has itself produced a second show called S-Town. It begins with a man named John who lives in Woodstock, Alabama. He reaches out to This American Life producer and S-Town host, Brian Reed, and he asks Reed to investigate crimes and corruption in his town. This happened all the way back in 2012. And over the 7 episodes that were all released simultaneously in a bingeable Netflix-style release, the series reveals itself to be not really true crime, but an examination of life in Woodstock and also the extraordinary life that John himself has led. And we're going to handle this podcast a little bit like we handled Get Out recently, if you heard that. What we're going to do is we're going to talk for a while about the production and the style of the show. We'll give you a warning. There's a kind of a turn at the end of the second episode. And when we're going to kind of get into what that turn is, we'll give you a little bit of a warning. First, I want to talk a bit about the general production of the show. Glenn, you have long been kind of my podcast guy. How did this strike you when you started listening to it?
Well, do you remember in 1994, there was a documentary called Crumb? Remember that?
Sure.
It was about R. Crumb, the cartoonist, and his family. I remember seeing that and thinking, that's, you know, very fascinating documentary. But like 20% of me thought, boy, you could just point a camera at this family. You got a story, you know?
Yeah.
Which is not true, of course. You have to build the thing around. This podcast starts with a clock metaphor that Reed will return to over the course of it. It seems very conventional. It seems like you're going into an episode of This American Life.
Yeah, and we have a little bit of that. And I want to play a little bit of that intro because the intro to me is so public radio.
Yeah.
I want to play a little bit of it.
When an antique clock breaks, a clock that's been telling time for 200 or 300 years, fixing it can be a real puzzle. An old clock like that was handmade by someone. It might take away the time with a pendulum, with a spring, with a pulley system. It might have bells that are supposed to strike the hour, or a bird that's meant to pop out and cuckoo at you.
I mean, that is what sitcoms think that public radio sounds
absolutely
like. And I don't say that negatively. Many wonderful things have been made over the years that are us, by which I mean public radio, broadly mm-hmm. speaking, being exactly what people think we are. But go ahead.
But just that narrative, that a lot of narrative nonfiction depends on that kind of framing device, which can often seem sweaty and overdetermined, mm-hmm. like it's reaching for something. Tidiness is a thing that narrative nonfiction needs to fight against yeah. in a big way. And I was worried about that. But then, just like Crumb, Reed points his microphone at John B. McLemore, and all of a sudden you realize we're going someplace completely different.
Yeah,
and I really enjoyed the ride that this thing led me on. It's and the fact that it's all done, like we know he releases it all at once, mm-hmm. changes our expectations, yeah. changes how we interact with it,
yeah,
changes everything about the feeling of this podcast.
Yeah, I agree. Stephen, you told me this morning that you had a lot of thoughts about it. What can you share kind of on this more general notion of it?
Glenn, you mentioned the ride that it takes, and I think the way that this thing was released is very, very important. And I think that if this thing had come out where they had doled out the episodes one a week, I think a lot of people would be talking about the first episode. And by the time they got to the second episode, they'd have spent all week talking about something that kind of gets dropped.
That kind of isn't the show.
That mm-hmm. isn't the show. And we'll get to the details of that a little bit later. But it is so interesting to me how different a story this is in episode 1 versus episode 4 versus episode 6.
I agree.
You can dole it out, but right. I took it in as one kind of 6.5 hour gulp.
Yeah.
And my thoughts on it are still really all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
As a whole, I absolutely love it. When I start to pick apart some of my issues with it, if I were to list them, it would sound like I didn't like this show.
Right. Mm-hmm. To me, it's very obvious. It's very well made. And I think that Brian Reed, the host, has enormous compassion
yeah.
and humanity in the way that he approaches everyone in this story, which I think the more you listen to it, the more you know how important that is. Mm-hmm. And I think he does a very, very good job of kind of not looking down on people. And anytime, as soon as you get that kind of traditional public radio opening going into a story about a small town in the South mm-hmm. from somebody who draws himself as an outsider, as like a reporter from New York, it mm-hmm. does start to make me really nervous because I worry that it's going to be touristy and it's going to be kind of either infantilizing
right.
or patronizing or kind of making people into curiosities. And there are places in this story that could have gone there. And I think they mostly stayed out of that ditch. What did you think, Margaret?
I had a hard time with this show. And sort of for one of the things that Glenn was praising it for, Glenn, you said the second that John, the sort of focal point of the show, started speaking, you know, your conception of the show changed and you got this feeling like you could just point a camera at this person and you'd have a story. I guess that's basically what this podcast does, and it's beautifully produced. It's compassionately composed. But there's this central tension about how much the subject knows they're revealing and how complicit they are and how they're being portrayed, especially with some of the stuff in terms of mental illness that this guy's struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, it was just hard for me to listen to. You know, it's stuff that I encounter in my day-to-day life, just loving people who struggle with depression. And it was just hard for me to get enough distance from it to appreciate the artistry and not be really mired in the ethics.
Yeah, I think that's really fair. And I wrote about this in the context of Missing Richard Simmons, which to me was a show that ultimately, I think my short version of my take was, it didn't justify its intrusiveness to me. It didn't justify what wasn't just intrusiveness into the life of a famous person. It was intrusiveness into the life of someone who had specifically decided to withdraw. And it didn't justify that to me. And I think that it didn't justify it ethically with the story that it was telling. I think there are a couple differences here that made me feel better about this than I did about Missing Richard Simmons. I would name actually three. One is what Stephen mentioned about one would be the way that they released the show. Because mm-hmm. one of the things that I think we learned from Serial is that the more you drag out what people perceive to be a mystery, the more you encourage amateur people to try to get ahead of the show by investigating on their own. And that makes people more intrusive than I think they become if they just listen to something that's already completed. You can imagine if you've heard the first episode of this show, how much Googling and Redditing and all that would be happening had they released it that way. I also think that there's more of a story here that is of value to other people about understanding a kind of life that we don't necessarily often get a good look at, a kind of person whose story isn't often told. So I think the underlying story justifies the invasiveness more. And then also, I think that although John, when he originally reached out to Brian Reed, it was about a very different kind of thing than they wound up investigating. I think one of the things that Reed discovers about John is that a lot of John's pain comes from really wanting to be heard and understood and to have the things that he's saying shared with other people, not only about the original thing he wrote the letters about. And I think that Reed eventually concludes that a lot of John's suffering that he has clearly gone through when he meets him comes from the fact that he doesn't feel like anybody's been listening to him. And so I think there is a way to say, even if he didn't know exactly what it was going to be about, his entire point was to be heard. He emerges in this story as somebody who discloses a lot, not only to Reed, but also he sends people information that you wouldn't think he would send. Right. So for me, it was different, but I definitely understand what Margaret's saying, too.
Yeah, I think all of the points that you've made are really trenchant, and that's why I wouldn't come down and say, like, this is out and out unethical. I just know that any time the storytelling took more of a turn into storytelling, there's almost a certain music cue that'll come in where it's like, oh, we're revealing some really juicy facet now.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there's a treasure hunt involved here. Anytime that kind of thing amped up, I just got, like, itchy palms.
I think we've pretty much all agreed it's well produced and it's well made, and Macklemore is a fascinating guy. And what I think we're going to do next is move on to talk a little bit about what comes out after the second episode. So please be aware that that is where we are headed. So if you want to remain completely fresh going in, this would be the place to skip ahead. And I will give you a little transitional moment to do your fast forwarding by saying I find it very unsettling to apply spoiler technology and rules and terminology to this information because things that happen to real people are not spoilers and things that are reported by reporters are not spoilable. And I feel very awkward about it, but I'm also trying to be respectful of how people want to experience it. So if you're still listening, that's where we're headed. At the end of the second episode, Brian Reed records the phone call in which he learns that John Macklemore has committed suicide. And he then spends the rest of the podcast, which is the other five episodes, trying to, I don't know, how would you describe what he's trying to do, Glenn?
I think this podcast, and this sounds weird to say, gave me a very good sense of the hole that people leave in the world when they go. Mm. And how, when the way they go is suicide, how much more raw and ragged the edges of that hole is and how hard it is to heal.
Mm-hmm.
You get a real sense of this town and the different voices and the people around him, and our sympathies keep shifting in a way that is obviously well-produced and obviously well thought out, but didn't seem to me disingenuous. It seemed like we were part of Reed's grappling with just the size of that hole and just who this guy was and how much that unhappiness, like looking for answers, a definitive cause of that unhappiness, if anything, that seemed a little pat. That seemed a little, that comes at the very, very end. And it left me less than satisfied with the thought of, with his potential explanation, because I think there's so much more going on there than
it also kind of feels like a weird dodge.
Yeah.
Right. To, instead of you're engaging with, like, you know, somebody who's struggling with depression, right, which is something huge numbers of people in the United States struggle with. You're like, oh no, like maybe it wasn't depression. Like maybe it's this even more extreme form of mental disorder from certain kinds of procedures he's doing.
But that's real too, though.
Yeah.
Like sure. That's also a real thing. And I think the part, what happens as you get closer to the end is they start to explore the possibility that it's mercury poisoning as a result of some of the work that he did refinishing and working on clocks. And to me, the thing that's useful about that is people are exposed to a lot of different things for a lot of different reasons. And the fact that what Glenn was talking about with kind of the rawness of the wound, the fact that one of the problems is you never really know what the combination of factors was made some sense to me. I know, Stephen, what were you going to say about this part of it?
It does manage to bring up a couple of huge issues that unfold over the course of several episodes, sort of about the shape of not only Southern life, but rural life in a way that is very, very vivid. And speaking as the person on this panel who grew up in a very small town, I felt like there were a lot of truths told over the course of this story as it really drills down into this guy's life about how hard it can be to muddle through in a world where you don't necessarily fit in. And I think there are so many generalizations that get made about rural life and about Southern life. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this went so much deeper and richer in really interesting ways. I think like I felt like each episode had like a drive-by truckers box sets worth of insight mm-hmm. into what it is like to be a fiercely intelligent yeah. person with a very conflicted relationship with the small town in which he
yeah,
lives. And
yeah.
I felt like mm-hmm. that stuff was incredibly powerful and a very important story to tell. And it's where yeah. it's where this thing really, really, really worked for me.
For a lot of people, it's going to be stereotype busting. And I think that's helpful. I mean, for a lot of people, I think what I was afraid was going to be kind of playing into imagery about Southern people in small towns and stuff like that may wind up doing the opposite.
And I think we talk so much about how this podcast gives you a rich picture of the life of John B. McLemore. It also gives you a rich picture of the life of Tyler Goodson, mm-hmm. his friend. And that, I hate saying character, because that is a person, that is a human being. That characterization, that story that's being told to me rang so familiar.
Yeah.
I grew up in rural Wisconsin. I have friends who went through life / go through life kind of constantly always making that slightly wrong choice mm-hmm. that sets off this escalating series of problems, which are magnified by poverty, which are magnified by upbringing, which are magnified mm-hmm. by a kind of nihilism. I was just fascinated by that guy.
Yeah.
There's a particular monologue that he goes through where he talks about sort of like the petty fine trap
yes.
that it's really easy to fall into in when you're living close to the poverty line, where, you know, he got fined for driving his car, he got his license suspended, and he had to keep driving his car because it's the only way he could get to work mm-hmm. to pay for the fines. And that means he got more fines. And then he just, you know, was in an unbreakable bind.
Yeah. And before we go, Stephen, you and I had also talked about another kind of reservation that you had about S-Town. And I don't want to miss having you talk about that.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue for me pops up around episode 6 when the show really delves into issues surrounding John B. McLemore's sexuality and some of the specifics of his relationships. And for me, this problem really comes to a head in episode 7 where Brian Reed is delving into the specifics of McLemore's relationship to pain and describing what sound to me like BDSM acts that are presented as equivalent to cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that felt like very sloppy speculation. First of all, he couldn't have known. And second of all, like it just didn't feel to me like enough care was taken with what is very, very sensitive information.
Yeah, it didn't feel sure-footed to you.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of folks have had a lot of positive and negative thoughts about S-Town. A lot of people have certainly heard it. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you thought about S-Town. And when we come back, we are going to talk about Netflix's series Chewing Gum. It's an import from Britain. And as you hear this, it's just come back for its second season. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed to eliminate food waste, along with step-by-step recipes for delicious meals designed to take 30 minutes to make. And everything is delivered in a special insulated box for free. Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners can receive $35 off their first week of deliveries. Just visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code HAPPYHOUR35 on your first purchase.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. By the time you're listening to this podcast, Netflix will have released the second season of the British comedy Chewing Gum. From the mind of its star, Michaela Cole, Chewing Gum follows Tracy, a young woman raised in London to be very religious, who decides that she wants very specifically to lose her virginity. And while that might seem like a pretty tired plot that's played out in a lot of different spaces, Tracy's combination of frankness and naivete combined with the spark in Cole's comedic voice gives it a fresh coat of paint. One of the first people I heard about chewing gum, I think, was Glenn.
Yep.
I think you are one of the first people who told me about it. What are your feelings about it? Because I know they're not 100% gung-ho at all times.
Not at all times. No, I describe this as a good old-fashioned sex comedy in which nothing about it feels old-fashioned. it is broad, very, very broad in its humor, but it's also kind of gleefully sexually, I wouldn't say graphic, I'd say sexually blunt. In an unapologetic way that I really like. It establishes the world of the Tower Block, which is the low-income housing that she lives in, not with quirky, twee, Gilmore Girls-y kind of thing, but you get to know these people, warts and all, and there's plenty of warts.
Yeah.
I just really dig it. I mean, I think that I think Susan Wacoma, who plays her sister, who is also in Crazy Head,
so
good. It's so funny. And, you know, I think this kind of points up something that we've talked about before, that, and you might disagree, Linda Holmes, but I think that good sex in fiction and television and movies can be boring to read and watch and write about. And I think bad sex is funny.
Yeah,
it's a very stark dichotomy.
I think if you've seen the very beginning of Bridesmaids,
yeah.
I think that's exactly what the beginning of Bridesmaids is based on. All right, I hear you laughing, Hula Hoop. What do you want to tell us about chewing gum?
Well, I had a very mixed response to S-Town, but I had a very positive response to chewing gum. It's just like right in that bright, saturated color palette that I'm wired to respond to really strongly. In fact, I did have like an uncomfortable realization that my wardrobe and the wardrobe of sexually repressed virgins on Netflix sitcoms are like almost identical.
The Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah.
The chewing gum. Yeah.
Yep. It's just right there. That's my aesthetic. But I just thought all of the actresses involved were so funny.
Yeah.
And I'm with Glenn. It's not like every joke didn't land, but there's such a density of jokes. And the ones that do hit so strongly that I was thoroughly enjoyed. And I'm really excited to see, I think, even more. Because if there's anything that's sort of tough about this is it really drops you very in media res. You don't get a ton of context for, like, especially Tracy's mom. The main character's religious mother, you sort of get a little bit more of her towards the end of this season, and I want to see her as a more active role in the coming season that's being released this week.
Yeah, you see a lot of her kind of preaching and scolding, but there's not that much of the actual mother-daughter relationship until fairly late. How about you, Thompson?
Yeah, the mom is really funny, though. There is a moment, I want to say like the fifth episode or something, where Tracy, there's this big, broad, loud fight going on, and she's trying to get everybody's attention, and she takes a glass and throws it on the floor to, you know, psh, but it just clanks and just bounces without breaking. And that made me laugh and laugh and laugh. And it reminded me how much raw material there is here.
Yeah.
At the same time, I watched this whole thing in bursts of about 5 minutes at a time. Because this is cringe comedy that leans so, so heavily on the cringing, that it almost, the cringing is the comedy. That level of characters being embarrassed for humor can be very exhausting in large doses. This, for me, was not a bingeable show. That's, I had to break it into pieces.
That's really interesting, because I think, especially when you're talking about Tracy, I don't necessarily know that I see her as embarrassed. Like,
yeah.
I think most of the time, I think she's not embarrassed. I think she is so legitimately exploratory and so inexperienced. But the thing is, like, sexually, she's inexperienced. But personally, she's very confident.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I think she kind of just throws herself into whatever she's trying, and she just tries it. And I don't think that she sits there and feels embarrassed and miserable about, I think you can be embarrassed for her. But to me, the cringe comedy that I find really hard to watch is when the person on screen is suffering. And
sure.
Most of the time, and I think since this is a show that's already kind of been around for a long time, I don't worry about giving out details. But I think when Tracy does something like she decides that she and her boyfriend are going to try to have a threesome with another woman who she picks up from Tinder or something.
Some equivalent.
She picks up. It sort of turns into this horrible thing. But part of what that's reflecting is just that for a lot of people, that seems like just such a weird thing to do. And I think she and her boyfriend wind up kind of feeling like this is a really weird thing to do. And parts of it are hot. Parts of it aren't terrible. But parts of it, she's just doing it to try to please her boyfriend. What I like about this show is it's not a show about sex to me as much as it is a show about pop culture ideas of sex. It's about sex to a person who's never gotten good sex education. So Tracy winds up being someone who gets all of her ideas about sex, I mean, from her one friend who enjoys posing as a person who knows a lot about sex, which I'm not 100% sure she actually is. And then from just kind of like out in the world, like Tracy has gotten the sense that you do this, and she tries to watch explicit movies to get an idea of what you do. And so none of her sexuality is genuine, but none of her sexual expression is really coming from her. And what I find so interesting about this show is it's about a woman who is trying to express her sexuality without figuring out like a sexual language of her own that is actually about what she is interested in and what she wants and what she thinks is hot. It's all based on these externalities. Am I
absolutely
that's a great point. I did write down, Glenn, you said something like it's very broad. I have written down here, underline, it's very, very broad.
Yeah. I mean, for example, like, she's got a boyfriend who is a poet. I would have liked him to be a bad poet in a slightly more, there's a lot of different ways to be bad poets.
So
right?
Many different ways.
And it doesn't necessarily be because you want to rhyme Tracy with Facey. That's one way, sure, but that seems
so
a little
funny, though.
It's funny. I'm not saying it's funny. What I love about this is the old Allen Gurganis thing, which we've talked about before. He's a novelist who says that in America, we have this Puritan streak, which means that as soon as the sex scene starts, we cut away to the gently wafting curtains because, you know, we just think, well, okay, now the important thing is they had sex, and now let's move on. He knows that there is so much characterization you can do that in the act, there is a lot you can tell about how they feel about each other, how they feel about themselves. And that's what that scene, especially that threesome scene, is all about. It's all about their kind of shifting dynamics, and it's important that we stay there. And it's just a way that, I mean, there's stuff that happened on the show that you could not get away with on HBO. There are there are bodily fluids, there are sexual aids, there are all kinds of stuff, there are pictures of
things.
There
are sexual aids, that is for sure, there sure are.
So I've read some comparisons to Insecure, the HBO show, and it just seems to me that a much more effective comparison is to Fleabag, because again, you have the person speaking to the camera, you have the frankness, you have the Britishness. It's a different class of Britishness, it's a different kind of Britishness, but it's all of a piece. I really
and also both are adapted from plays.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, because Michaela Cole had put this together as a play before it became television. And if you're interested in her, which I would argue you should be, there are some really good profiles. The Guardian has written about her a few times, and there's some really good stuff from them, because she herself spent some time as an evangelical Christian, and she's not dismissive of it as much as you might think that this kind of over-the-top portrayal of religion-driven sexual repression might suggest, she still feels, I think, that she got a lot out of that part of her life. It's just not what she's doing now. I think that what Glenn said about the fact that there are things in this show that you couldn't do on HBO, wouldn't do on HBO, I think you discover when you watch this show, you're like, oh yeah, no, even the things I think of as not having taboos still have taboos.
Yeah.
Like, you can look at stuff and you're like, oh, you wouldn't see that. Yep. No, definitely not. But you enjoyed it, Margaret?
I loved it. I feel like we've done a certain amount of saying like, oh, isn't this a tired story? You know, a person wants to lose their virginity. But I actually don't know how common it is for it to be sort of like a woman-authored, woman-centric version of that story. Mm-hmm. I think you did such a good job of talking about the lack of subjectivity and how women understand their own sexuality and the way that we're sort of pressured to express it through existing vernaculars that were never designed to make us happy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
and
right.
And so to watch someone dealing with all of that in such an unabashed and funny way, and who's, like, really irrepressible, she doesn't just get stymied in this stuff, is so refreshing. I loved it.
Yeah. I think you get that sense that, just like you said, the ways that she's trying to express her interest in sex are not really, as I said, about herself. Yeah. And I think that when you have had these stories about I want to lose my virginity, there's something about it that is seen as like I just want to get it out of the way. And I think for her, what they're trying to convey is she has some of that, but she also has a legitimate desire in sex and having sex and being sexy. I think for a lot of women on television, what you see is a line between either you are repressed in that you won't talk about sex, or you're worldly and you have lots of great sex. And I think what this is showing is there is something beyond becoming comfortable talking about sex and becoming comfortable, like, saying sex words. You know what I mean? Like, what? I can go into any place and say whatever word you want. I can talk about whatever bodily function you want. That is not necessarily progress toward giving yourself a good sex life. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that Margaret and I both, like, are kind of so into the...
I'm just leaning back.
Yeah. Margaret and I are both, like, more fascinated, I think, by its portrayal of young women and sex than you guys are. Who knew? All right. Come and find us at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ZipRecruiter. When you own a business, if you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. Thanks to ZipRecruiter, you can post to 200-plus job sites with one single click and have the highest chance of finding that perfect candidate. Plus, you can instantly be matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Businesses of all sizes have used ZipRecruiter. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/happyhour.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin with NPR News. And you know what? We're doing something new, and we want you to be part of it. It's called Up First. It's the morning news podcast from NPR. It's a way for you, in about 10 minutes or so, to get up to speed on the news of any given day. The most important stories, the biggest ideas, the stuff you need to know as you go through your day. Up First, it starts April 5th. You can get it at NPR One or anywhere you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, it is the beginning of April, and I have finally, after a whole entire month, gotten around to seeing Get Out. I went to the movies and saw this thing, which meant, among other things, I could finally listen to the episode of this show that you guys did talking about this movie. I had so incredibly much fun. You guys talked about a great many of this film's attributes, but I noticed you guys did not mention the performance of Lil Rel Howery, who plays the main character's best friend, who is warning him, usually on the phone, warning him, you know, don't go in the house. He's the dog sitter, the friend. He is given all of the, not quite all, but almost all of the biggest, funniest, juiciest lines. He is so incredibly funny in this movie. So Lil Rel Howery in particular.
Thank you, Stephen. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Have you guys checked out Trial and Error on NBC yet?
I have not. No. I've seen the trailer.
Yeah. The trailer does not sell the show. Watch the first episode and start from the beginning. Absolutely. It's about a man accused of murdering his wife. It's a mockumentary format. Stars John Lithgow as Larry and Nick DeGusto as Josh, his lawyer. Tuesday nights on NBC. On one level, it's a network saying, you know, The Office? Do that for true crime. Because the bones of this thing, I mean, there are many, many puzzled looks that are shot at the camera by Nick DeGusto. But what matters is that the jokes are funny. And that is loaded up with really good character beats. Sherry Shepherd is on it, and she's very funny. And yeah, so it is working for me in a big way, even though you will recognize the structure of it, which is, I think, starting to get a little long in the tooth, that particular mockumentary format. Mm-hmm. But Trial and Error on NBC.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Margaret Hula Hoop Willison, what is making you happy this week?
I have been having a little bit of a board game renaissance because I have a friend locally who's starting a business where he stages board game nights in bars the same way you'd stage a trivia night, which means I've been playing all kinds of board games that I haven't played before, and they're great. So I was going to mention two specifically that I feel like people in pop culture happy hour land might like. So one is called Paperback. And if you started out with games and you love Scrabble, and then you became addicted to Bananagrams, and you were like, what's the next spelling word game that I can play now that I'm familiar with both of these? Paperback is a great option. You build a deck of particular cards, you get 7 at a time, and you're tasked to spell out words. So like with Scrabble, you have a little bit of time to sort of plot in advance how you're going to spell the word you're going to spell and what points you're going to get for it. But it's much more nimble, the way a lot of more independent board games are. And then the other one is called Mysterium, and it's sort of a take on Clue. You have to get a murder suspect, a murder weapon, and a murder location, just like in Clue. But instead of going through sort of a tedious process of elimination where you ask yes or no questions, one person in the game knows everything they need to know. You're trying to find it out, and you hint back and forth using weird pictures. Where, like, I put down one weird picture, and you're supposed to figure out which of the 5 other weird pictures it's most like by my subjective taste. So it adds this element of weirdness. It's pretending to be a séance. That's so much fun and gives you so much time for sort of creative expression among your friends and, like, such a weaponized way to use your friendships against one another.
Oh, cool. I'm into that.
And if you're in Boston, come out and play board games with me at Board Game Empire, because it's the greatest.
Thank you very much, Margaret H. Willison. So I was on vacation last week, so I did not get a chance to mention last week, but I hope that you will all listen. I got to guest host Bullseye.
Yes, you did.
Normally, Jesse Thorne's show, Jesse was having a little bit of paternity leave. You know how that goes. And asked me to sit in and host Bullseye. So it's kind of like, as I have been saying, it's like what it would sound like if I was an NPR host. So I did a couple interviews. I interviewed Gina Prince Bythewood, who did Love and Basketball and Beyond the Lights, and also is doing Shots Fired with her husband for Fox. And I also interviewed the McElroys, who do My Brother and Me, and many, many, many other podcasts. So I got to do both of those interviews. I got to host Bullseye. It was super fun.
Mm-hmm.
B, my real recommendation, I spent a lot of time listening to music while I was on vacation. And one of the things that I always fall back on is my various lists that various music discovery programs pop out at me, like recommended for you. Try this, try this. And sometimes I like them because they don't only recommend new music. They also recommend old music that they think I might enjoy. And because I'm an old person who sometimes listens to ballady, sad old music, I got a little song on one of my lists that I very much enjoyed. And I'm going to play a little tiny bit of it for you.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
So that is Vera Lynn is her name, singing it. Nightingale sang in Berkeley Square, and that's such a pretty song. And when I was in college, there was an a cappella arrangement kicking around of that song that I think maybe Manhattan Transferred did at some point. So I have loved that song for a long time, and I came upon this Vera Lynn version. And I started looking into who she is, and I didn't know a whole lot about her. She was a wartime British woman singer who did, you know, beautiful stuff that British soldiers would listen to when they were out, you know, huddling under blankets and tarps, as you can read about when you read about her. So I was reading about her, and I went and looked at her Wikipedia page, and I was like, holy moly, she's 100 years old.
Yep.
She's still alive,
yep.
And
wow.
She just released an album,
yep.
called Vera Lynn 100, which is reorchestrated.
Yeah.
It's her original vocals.
Okay.
So may we all be Vera Lynn putting out a new album when we are 100 years old. So that is what is making me happy this week, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, and you can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. That's M.R.S. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you, at 100 years old, are waving your arms to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.